Okay, they showed a lot of the singers, but only one little shot of that bass player, man. That was a rumble. Thanks for listening. WEFT, Champaign Urbana, listener-sponsored and volunteer-operated radio. My name's Paul Muth. News from Neptune, I call it the radio edit. Don't accept a substitute. No, I encourage wide consumption of dissident views. Mainstream still doing a lousy job, particularly on economic issues. One of the antidotes is somebody who went to, just last week I replayed an excerpt from Dean Baker of Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's got a column, Beat the Press, where he looks at the newspapers of record and their economic reporting. It's very ideological, it seems to me, without having to defend that. Amy Goodman's got a commentary. Nothing from me, Mumi Abu-Jamal this week. I hope he's doing okay. I am going to replay a segment that I did get from prisonradio.org, and that is an interview that a WPFW gent did with Janine Jackson, who is with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Played the entirety of it. It's about 20 minutes long. It's worth seeking out if you want to know some basics about the case and the coverage thereof. So, but economic issues I return to, despite the fact there's so much going on. Are we going to have a minimum corporate tax? Are we going to have a wealth tax, you know? ProPublica got all these documents, tax leaks, and Elizabeth Warren said, this shows why we need a wealth tax, and the state, Attorney General said, we need to investigate the leak. Like that shouldn't be common in knowledge what people are paying. And, might have to start out with a different commentary here since got Greg Palast for the second half hour, election protection, election theft report, variously titled through the years. Played it leading up to the 2016 election and playing it now because there's so many shenanigans going on, seems like. Janine Jackson. Okay, that's what this is. All right, without any other fol-de-rol. Oh, you think at the G7, our president is putting the juice on Merkel as she's leaving her position in the head of the German Republic, whatever it's called, Deutschland? She's the one who bowed out of the TRIPS waiver, allowing for there to be production all over the world of vaccinations, as opposed to magnificently giving some more money to the Pfizers and Modernas to produce it, in a year or so. The urgency doesn't seem to be there. And I keep beating the drum of the Birch by Bob Dole bill, which sort of gave all this largesse to the pharmaceuticals, but it includes itself. If there's a lot of money spent on a product or technique, the U.S. government on its own can enjoin Big Pharma to license the process, et cetera. In other words, we don't have to wait for WTO. We don't have to wait for Germany. We were really authentic about not mostly wanting to ensure the profits of Big Pharma. We'd be doing that. So, something I covered last week and was successful, we're celebrating a little bit. Amy Goodman's got a commentary about oil pipelines, and that's what we're going to hear next. Then Janine Jackson talking about Mumia's case. Then that economic discussion with the ProPublica person. There's a pretty good coverage on Democracy Now! This week. Oh, I just wanted to mention a highlight of the week for me was Democracy Now! And nobody else covering the tour of Julian Assange's father and half-brother. And I believe they're going to be in Chicago at some point. So I don't know. Haven't had a road trip north in a while. That would be neat to meet them. Obviously, doesn't get much coverage here in the corporate-dominated press. All right, that's enough of a rant. Here's Amy Goodman's, and she's going to be breaking the sound barrier here.
Power in numbers. Water protectors rally against the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. 3, 200, 419. These numbers help explain this moment in the worsening climate crisis. 419 is the latest atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide in parts per million, as reported by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. That's right, it's pronounced Noah, just like the Old Testament character who predicted a climate catastrophe and was ignored until it was too late. That's 50% over pre-industrial levels and the highest concentration in over 4 million years. By comparison, the Climate Action Organization 350.org is named after the scientific consensus that atmospheric CO2 concentration should not exceed 350 parts per million if the planet is to avoid irreversible climate catastrophe. The number 3 refers to Enbridge Line 3, a pipeline currently under construction designed to carry almost 1 million barrels of tar sands oil daily from Canada into the United States. Line 3's intended route passes under indigenous lands in northern Minnesota, crossing scores of rivers and streams, wetlands, and through wild rice beds. And 200 is the approximate number of water protectors arrested on June 7th during the largest act of nonviolent civil disobedience against Line 3 construction to date. An indigenous women-led mobilization is now underway, reminiscent of the mass movement that opposed the Dakota Access Pipeline on unceded Lakota territory in 2016.
You know, it's a brand new corridor through our prime territory of wild rice, our clam beds, our fish, all of our territory.
That's Winona LaDuke, the renowned Anishinaabe activist and leader in the fight against the pipeline, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
We've stood and tried every process to stop this. I'm someone, along with all of these other women water protectors in our tribes, we spent 7 years in the regulatory process. And now what we see is even Joe Biden sends in a helicopter to go and start hurting our people. You know, our people have had very little recourse. We have none. You know, and so now we've come to go stand, and thousands of people have come to join us.
The protests included a march of over 1,500 people to occupy the spot where Line 3 would cross the Mississippi River, very close to the famous river's headwaters. Downriver, 500 more water protectors marched on the pipeline's Twin Inlets pumping station. There, 24 activists locked themselves to heavy machinery, and another 24 locked themselves to a large motorboat on a trailer, blocking vehicle access to the site. As the hours passed, police, reportedly from 31 different jurisdictions, escalated tactics, eventually deploying the LRAD. That's the long-range acoustical device, in an attempt to disrupt the civil disobedience. A federal Customs and Border Patrol helicopter buzzed the protesters, kicking up sand and rocks amidst the lockdown. Again, Winona LaDuke.
What you got is a political and a human rights and environmental crisis. We have petitioned to every federal agency, and so far we have had no response. It just seems that Joe Biden wants to see if a bunch of Indian people and older women are going to get hurt up in northern Minnesota before it's an important enough issue for Biden to look at.
President Biden has the authority to block the Line 3 pipeline. So in addition to occupying its construction path, water protectors are organizing a mass campaign to pressure the Biden administration. Grassroots organizing works, as was demonstrated by the declaration Wednesday by TC Energy, formerly TransCanada, that it's formally abandoning its planned Keystone XL pipeline. Rescinding the permit for Keystone XL was one of Biden's first acts as president. Enbridge seems to understand the power of mass movements. In a line from its 2020 annual report, the company admitted, quote, increased environmental activism against pipeline construction and operation could potentially result in work delays, reduced demand for our products and services, increased legislation, or denial or delay of permits and rights of way, they wrote. While water protectors continue to arrive at the Mississippi's headwaters, Biden is off to Europe on his first trip abroad as president. Among his stops is the meeting of the G7 group of wealthy industrialized nations that includes the U.S. as well as Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United Kingdom. These countries currently account for over a quarter of greenhouse gas emissions, but according to climate activists, are collectively shirking their climate finance commitments to fund global efforts to respond to the pollution they've caused. Meanwhile, a virtual summit is underway to plan for November's COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, which was canceled last year due to the pandemic. Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg has said she'll boycott the meeting if wealthy nations don't take swift action to deliver vaccine equity to poorer nations, and many other international organizations are considering joining her. How many water protectors have to be arrested before world leaders, President Biden paramount among them, seriously commit to a rapid, just transition off of our addiction to fossil fuels? How dangerously high must the concentration of carbon dioxide rise in our shared atmosphere? The numbers don't lie, and the clock is ticking. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
She had me going there for a minute. Keystone's out, but Enbridge is on. Line three. I heard there were 1,000 grandmothers there, not just Native Americans. Winona LaDuke highlighting that. Okay, so in lieu of Mumia's own commentary, I'm going to play a little excerpt of a piece that's up at Prison Radio. Like I say, it's a bit of a backgrounder, having the media critic from FAIR do it incorporates a lot of critique of the coverage, contemporaneous with the trial, and a little comment at the very end about it's not gotten much better. There is a new trial date set, and got a different judge, since the judge that was going to have it was going to have been the DA that tried him, so that didn't stand. Though it took pressure to put that away. It's crazy. All right. Again, this is an excerpt. You can find the whole 22 or 23 minutes of it at prisonradio.org. There's a lot of commentaries up from a lot of different voices. It's amazing. So we'll start running them. A lot of them are much longer than Mumia. Mumia's, I guess, thinking of radio, since he was a radio stringer for public radio in Philly, as well as being a journalist for a weekly, and as well as being a friend of MOVE. I commend your attention, if you missed it, the commentary he does about the bones of the MOVE kids who he knew being used in an academic situation. That's been remedied, but it's astonishing that it went on at all.
And it's worth talking about. I mean, some of it were just straight up lies. You know, Sam Donaldson, who was the host, you know, said during this 2020 episode that he just misrepresented the case fundamentally, you know, and said that three eyewitnesses all say they saw Jamal run from across the street and shoot the officers in the back. Like, he just stated the prosecution case as if it were fact. And that's kind of a telltale thing throughout the thing. So you would never guess from that one of the witnesses, actually, when they were asked by police, did you see which male shot the officer, actually replied, no, all I saw was the flash from the gun. You wouldn't guess from Donaldson's characterization that another one of the witnesses misidentified Jamal after the shooting, and that another witness repeatedly changed their story multiple times after being arrested by police. So it gave this very one-sided characterization. And yet it then said, in Donaldson's words, this is part of the spectacular array of evidence for Mumia's guilt. You know, so they stated things that if a person were able to read the court record, they would know that this was just a re-quoting of the prosecution, and that it ignored all kinds of other things. But as you're a TV viewer watching 2020, you don't know. But what I really also wanted to point out is, because, as I say, the problem with media, some corporate media, was that it was a cause celeb. So this 2020 episode had Ed Asner, and they had him on, you know, they quoted him, and they quoted him saying no ballistic tests were done, which is pretty stupid. Okay. And then you hear Sam Donaldson's voiceover to cut in and say, but ballistic tests were done. You know,
yeah, so I remember
he
comes that.
In and he counters Ed Asner. Except the thing is, when Donaldson says ballistics tests were done, he's talking about tests that said that the bullet that killed Daniel Faulkner was the same caliber or might have been the same caliber as Mumia Abu-Jamal's gun. He's not saying that there were ballistics done on the actual gun, or that the gun had ever been fired, or that there was nothing connecting the gun that they connected to Mumia. He's just saying, yeah, they did some ballistics tests, and he's not actually countering Ed Asner's point at all. Mm-hmm. You know, and the point is that police didn't perform any tests to see whether Mumia Abu-Jamal's gun had been fired, whether there was gunpowder residue on his hands. Those tests weren't done, and so what Asner was saying was completely correct. But Donaldson and ABC did this thing where, you know, they step in as the omniscient voice and tell the viewer, yeah, ignore this person, you know, and listen to me. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they were telling lies about that. And what I would finally say is, when they did use interviews during that 2020 episode, when they did use some language from Mumia, first of all, they took audio from an interview. They didn't even get permission. They just took audio from another interview, which anybody who does media knows you don't do. And then the thing that they did was to add this like echo to it.
Ominous.
Depth, you know, like they made it sound weird. They altered it, you know. And then finally, in case anyone wondered watching it, but the thing is, viewers of 2020 didn't know. But what journalists who dug into it afterwards found out was that when they tried to get an interview with Mumia at the time, which they didn't get, they stated flat out to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections that they were working with Maureen Faulkner, Daniel Faulkner's widow, and that they were working with the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police. So this is 2020. This is media saying they're doing a neutral or objective conversation. And in fact, they're using flat out falsehoods, and they're also ignoring defense arguments and hyping prosecution arguments to a degree that really no journalist would consider acceptable. And this has kind of been par for the course in media's coverage of Mumia's case.
Mm-hmm. So right now, after 40 years, and then Mumia has been incarcerated for 40 years, most of those, I don't know, about maybe half of them on death row or at this point, but he was taken off the death row in 2011, I think. But now, the whole lot of information, I don't know how much you've been keeping up with the case, has come out that make it, you know, really meaty, newsworthy story. You know, the boxes of evidence that were held in the DA's office, the judges that wouldn't recuse themselves with it after they presided, after being prosecutors in the case, and different things like that. But now the story's it's nothing. It's gone dark or you know, just kind of absent. What do you make of that? How can they get away with doing that? I guess they just do it.
The story with Mumia has always been that he is an eloquent voice for incarcerated people and for people who corporate media would rather not hear from. And I feel that although much has changed, certainly since 1982, I feel that not that much has changed in many ways. And I still feel that as a voice for people that corporate media don't want to have a voice, that he still occupies that same place. And, you know, I looked up because I realized how long ago this has been, and it was kind of shocking to me, you know. So I thought, let me look at some recent coverage. And I found a thing from WHYY, which is public media in Philadelphia, you know, their public radio and television. And they were talking about, you know, he's just had his 67th birthday. He's just come through this heart surgery. And it said, and they're kind of, I often think you can find media in their little boilerplate, in their little snapshot of a story. And so, you know, they said, describing Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, WHYY said, the case has pitted Abu-Jamal's supporters, including a long list of national and international celebrities who say he was framed, against police and their supporters, who resent the attention given to a man convicted of murdering a fellow officer. So what that tells me, Netfa, is that for news media, it's still very much just a case about how people feel about it. It's like there's no reality there. Has a person been wrongly convicted? has a person, even if they were rightly convicted, served a bizarre amount of time for the crime they've supposedly been convicted of, that's off the page. For news media, the case of Umayya Abu-Jamal is just a case about how people feel about celebrities getting involved in issues and how people feel about police. And, it's lost its reality. It's lost the fact that this is a human being behind bars that we should care about and that represents many, many, many other people behind bars that we should care about and that we can't hear from. So I'm very frustrated to see how much media's coverage has not changed since the very beginning of this case when Mumia first went to jail.
Now, you know, a lot of this.
And they might even say that he had has a new trial coming up on the substance of the whole charge. All right. Now, up front, this is a daily show out of KPFA. That was from WPFW. I don't often go to them, but that was Janine Jackson, who you can hear on the program Counterspin, a project of fairness and accuracy in reporting, half hour of media criticism from a different point of view, it seems to me. And let's see, about 20 after, got about a 10-minute segment on this. Again, Amy Goodman had some good commentary, and this Chuck Collins I've been playing a while, talking about how the rich get away with all this, how many people they pay to pay as little as they pay. Brian Edwards-Tiekert does a great job of bringing this to you in this short 10 minutes. You know, they don't talk about things like the transaction tax, which also wouldn't affect people who are holding their assets, buy, hold, and die. It's one of the things that came up. You buy it, you get your basis, and when you die, you pay no taxes on it at all. Yeah, I guess there's some estate taxes, but those have been chipped away too, right? So transaction tax wouldn't catch the wealth holders. Wealth tax would. Capital levy, it has been used in places. It's not that alien of a concept. But in the U.S. press on financial issues, particularly bad. It's a corporate press, corporate media, and they know where their money is coming from. All right, Brian Edwards-Tuckett, morning show on KPFA. ProPublica, commend your attention to the Pacific Democracy Now! Coverage of it, too, which is a bit longer than this, but I wanted to do something about the wealth, the wealthy. I won't say anything about Bezos and his brother reaching escape velocity and maybe going away forever, but I guess I just did.
Investigative newsroom ProPublica got their hands on a massive trove of IRS data that they used to put together an investigation published yesterday showing how the wealthiest people in this country managed to pay extraordinarily small amounts of taxes relative to their increase in wealth. We're joined now by one of the people who worked in that investigation, Jeff Ernsthausen, senior data reporter at ProPublica. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I know you can't share how you got your hands on the data. Can you briefly explain what it is?
In a nutshell, we have tax records on thousands of the wealthiest Americans over 15 years. And that includes a lot of the household names like Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and others who are sort of the wealthiest of the wealthiest Americans.
What did you learn about how extraordinarily wealthy people structure their tax lives?
Yeah, so our story focuses on a very basic concept, which is that you and I and most of the listeners out there, we earn wages or salary and taxes are taken out of that automatically every month. But the ultra wealthy, they're not in the tax system the same way. The bulk of their wealth, as it grows, it's not taxed until they choose to do something like sell a stock, for instance. So they can accrue vast wealth, which is really a lot like income for the rest of us, and not pay taxes on it until they choose to do so.
Warren Buffett famously calculated how he benefits from the tax system and came to the conclusion that he pays a lower effective tax rate than his secretary. You went through the figures, compared his increase in wealth to what he's actually paid in taxes, and came to the conclusion that what you call his true tax rate is 0.1%.
Yes, Warren Buffett is somewhat of a kind of an exemplar of this. So Berkshire Hathaway somewhat famously doesn't pay dividends. And so Warren Buffett's wealth grows without him taking taking dividend payments from Berkshire Hathaway. And so his income is very, very low relative to his wealth growth every year. And so his wealth went up by more than $20 billion between 2014 and 2018. And he paid about $20 million in taxes, which works out to a very small fraction of that growth in wealth.
Now, you're doing the math the way you just described. You call this the true tax rate. I saw a lot of the like wonk class kind of jumped on this presentation of the data on Twitter after your story dropped yesterday and saying, yeah, but no country in the world actually does taxes that way. Nobody taxes capital gains before they're realized, before you sell the capital asset. Like, how do you respond to the argument that this isn't a useful metric?
You know, I think for normal people, income is, you know, as it's traditionally thought of, is the bulk of the picture, right? It's coming, they're earning most of their money in wages, and maybe they get a little bit of appreciation on their house or something like that, right? For these guys, like, appreciation is almost the entire picture. It's completely inverted. And so we have a tax system that considers everything that's important for the average person in terms of how they make a living to be taxable. And for the wealthiest, what's most important to them is not taxable.
One of the interesting maneuvers you document is someone with a lot of money tied up in rapidly appreciating investments can borrow money for the purposes of managing their life and wind up reporting negative income. Tell me about your team's conversations with Carl Icahn.
Yeah, so you do have folks who are investors who are able to write off interest expenses against their income, and that can produce years where they have zero tax liability, and as far as the IRS is concerned. You also have other people who are, you know, more in the sort of startup class. For instance, Elon Musk, who can borrow against their huge holdings of stock, much as, you know, other people would borrow against their house, right? And so if you are faced with the choice of paying, you know, 20% in capital gains or taking a wage and paying 37% or taking out a loan at 3%, it's a relatively easy choice, right?
Right. So they borrow at rates that are astonishingly low to those of us who are part of the regular credit market. They claim the interest on those loans as expenses. And then someone extraordinarily wealthy can tell the IRS at the end of the year, I actually had negative income, no taxes, please.
Well, I think it depends on what they're using that money for. So some interest expenses can be written off, some can't. But you are able to, you know, if you have to decide between, you know, losing, say, some control of your company because you want to spend some money, or borrowing and retaining control of those shares. That's kind of the decisions that the ultra wealthy face that obviously are not part of most people's lives, right?
Right. The other policy argument would be that that money gets taxed. It just gets taxed before it gets into wealthy people's pockets. That's the point of a corporate income tax.
Yeah. So a lot of economists, most economists think that, you know, when you start to figure out who actually pays various taxes in our society, we have a lot of taxes that are not direct, that the shareholders, you know, directly bear a large percentage of corporate taxes. And so, you know, it's a fair point that that is part of the tax picture. It's not part of what we are looking at, a part of the records we're looking at. But it's certainly part of the picture. Though I will note that there's also been a lot of reporting in recent years about the ways in which companies have tried to shift their tax burdens to low tax jurisdictions in order to move out of that system. And you have a lot of companies that are not paying particularly high corporate tax bills, especially you know, companies that are internet companies or new startups, let's say.
And the corporate tax rate, of course, reduced under the signature legislative achievement of the Trump administration, the 2017 tax bill. Talk to me about what the Biden administration's put on the table in terms of tax reforms, some of the funding mechanisms they floated for the infrastructure bill. Would any of them produce any significant change to what you've documented?
Yeah, I think insofar as, you know, one thinks the tax that shareholders bear, the brunt of the corporate tax, you know, adjusting that rate would fall more heavily on this group. To the extent that folks in this group are making, when they do realize income, but it's in the form of capital gains, the discussion about moving up the capital gains rate on people taking capital gains over $1 million would have potentially a big impact on them. That said, you know, this discussion about shifting rates leaves aside the fundamental issue that we're talking about here, which is that unless they do something, they're not going to face taxes. Unless somebody sells shares or otherwise takes an action, they're not going to pay taxes on it. So it wouldn't change the fundamental picture of what we wrote about in our article.
As part of your diligence, you tried to reach out to many of the billionaires whose financial lives you were documenting and writing about. What did you hear back from them?
Yeah, we reached out to everyone mentioned in this story to get their feedback. We tried to represent that as well as possible in the story. Folks have sort of honed in on, you know, basically that they're paying what's legal, and we're not saying otherwise. That's the story is about the system that we have and the ways in which legally the ultra wealthy pay very low taxes relative to the way they accrue fortunes.
A very, very choice quote from investor Charles Icahn in here. Quote, do you think a rich person should pay taxes no matter what? I don't think it's germane. How can you ask me that question? It does seem nice that he picked up the phone for you guys.
He did. He's very gracious with his time, and we talked with him at length.
Did not like the suggestion that he should be paying as much taxes as, say, you or me.
He obviously had issues with the story.
All right. Jeff Ernsthausen, I want to thank you so much for speaking to us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Jeff Ernsthausen is a senior data reporter at ProPublica. They managed to lay their hands on a treasure trove of data from the IRS. They're not saying how exactly, but they have corroborated against outside sources, documenting the financial and tax lives of some of the wealthiest people in this country. They used it to calculate what they're calling the true tax rate, how much taxes were paid relative to the increase in wealth of some of the wealthiest people in the country. And it is extraordinarily low, in the 1% or under range for figures like Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos,
and other guys like that. An Icahn. I guess he's got time on his hand. He's bourgeois or super rich or something. Doesn't really do much. Except watch his capital grow. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. That was Brian Edward Tickert on a morning show out of KPFA called Upfront. They do a Monday morning a COVID update with a great doctor that I try to listen to. It's all podcastable too, so. Anyway, I've got only enough time to play this last segment, and that is an election theft report recorded on Monday. Might have been some developments since then. I don't know. Any more state legislators pass voter suppression and this week? That won't be updated on that, but always engaging Greg Palast with Dennis Bernstein. Regular feature when I can get it and when they do it. And like I say, there's a lot going on. Did they get the tax records of ex-president? I wonder that we've heard those going to be reinstated in August.
And then if they tabulate it very late, which they shouldn't be doing, they'll see you voted, and so it won't count. So send it in early, and then go and vote. And if it's not tabulated, you vote, and the vote is going to count.
Who would have ever thought that it would be one lone Democratic senator that would finally put an end to the voting system, the one-person, one-vote system we've been trying to achieve in this country? Who would have thought? Maybe it's time now to make his name into a verb, as in mansioning or crippling a structural system of voting. Like in, he mansioned the voting system, and can you believe it? He's a Democrat. Joining us to talk about this and other insanities is our good friend Greg Palast, gregpalast.crime. We have started and been doing for some time the Election Crimes Bulletin. Can you imagine? How about a verb from mansion, Greg?
Well, sometimes I'm feeling mansioned, so, you know, it happens.
Charlie Mansioned,
We're all getting mansioned right now. Just so people are in on the joke, Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, nominal Democrat, has said two things. He will not break the filibuster, which is the ability of, if you need 60 senators to stop a debate. You need only 50 senators plus the vice president breaking a vote to pass legislation. But you can block having a vote. In other words, you can actually kind of block the democratic process when Rand Paul says, I'm just going to keep talking, which he has done, he said he will filibuster, that is, he will talk to death the voting rights bill. Now, people should understand, when Manchin has now actually gone, moved to the right, because he actually did say some months ago that he would consider, on the issue of voting rights, an adjustment to the filibuster rule just for that issue. But now he said, no, he won't touch filibuster. He also said he doesn't agree with the voting rights bill because it has no Republicans endorsing it, and he believes in bipartisanship. Well, maybe he could tell me the name of the bipartisan, ready-to-bargain Republican. There ain't one. And Mitch McConnell told his caucus that this would be devastating. Mitch McConnell will not permit any Republican off the reservation to vote for the two voting rights bills. And the one is the John, let me fill you in also.
Go over them, Greg. Brief us on both those bills so people know where we stand at the federal level.
Yeah, one is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. It's very short, but in my opinion, it is the key one because it restores the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was gutted by the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court said you can't use what's called preclearance. Now, what does that mean? That sounds fancy, but it's really simple. You can't steal someone's vote without asking the permission of the Justice Department. And now that we actually have a Justice Department, as opposed to the Attorney General of Injustice, Bill Barr, our current Attorney General under Biden is very committed to voting rights. So you have to, if for example, Georgia does things like, as we've reported, like arrest you for a felony crime if you hand pizza to someone in line, they have to get that new rule approved by the Justice Department to say this does not affect black voters or various religions or ethnic groups. This does not hit them especially hard. And you can't do that. The pizza might sound nonpartisan. It ain't, because the big long lines are only at universities and only in black communities. So that type of thing. And of course, the Georgia's new move, for example, in many other states to either cut back or eliminate drop boxes, to cut back or eliminate early voting, etc. So we will restore the Justice Department review to prevent the return of Jim Crow. You can't change rules unless justice says. And it also has another value, because when you send a note to the Justice Department saying, we're about to make pizza, drop boxes, and early voting illegal, a crime, then that notifies all the voting rights groups, not just justice, and they can take action. So that is vitally important. And all that does, it's not a radical change. It merely restores the Voting Rights Act that we had up until 2013 when the right-wing five killed it. That's one. Then we have a second act, which is, it's really quite big, 900 pages long, gone under different names. They call it the big rights bill. It not only gives all kinds of restores to people and gives to the American public a real, true protection of votes, everything from same-day registration, so you can, and that's important because we talked about purges. 24 million people every 2 years get removed from the voter rolls. 24 million people. You show up and your name's missing, register on the spot, just bring some ID. The second is that it makes mail-in voting accessible to everyone throughout the nation. It makes early voting accessible to everyone throughout the nation. It requires that you have a minimum number of precincts. So you can't say, 200,000 black voters get one precinct, and in the white suburbs, they have 200,000 polling stations. I'm exaggerating, but I can tell you, when I was in Ohio, Dennis, and we discussed this back in the last election, there were five-hour waits in Dayton and zero waits in Black City Central, five-hour waits to vote, no waits. They had so many polling stations, so many poll workers in the white suburbs of Toledo that the poll workers were lined up waiting for voters. I kid you not. So that stuff is all prohibited. There's two other aspects to the voting rights bill, the bigger bill. One is voting rights to make your vote more powerful than money. And that means there would be a lockdown limit on private funding of elections. It would be much harder to purchase an election. So there's limits and also exposure on who's buying the election. So the money is a big part of that bigger bill. The other, and finally, what may in the end be the most consequential, it prohibits gerrymandering. It says that, believe it or not, that in a gerrymander, the politicians pick the voters instead of the voters picking the politicians. And this is vital, especially because this is the year right now in 2021 when the GOP does not have the majority of voters in America. It's a minority party. However, it does have the vast majority of state legislatures which draw the lines for congressional districts and state legislatures so that it keeps Republican control of the state legislatures, and even more important, it means that the Republicans will be drawing lines, therefore, they can play the game they've played. Right now, you've had something like, and I'm sure someone will call and correct me, but I believe it was about the Democrats had a plurality of congressional votes by roughly several million. I believe it was about 5 to 7 million votes. That's typical. So Democrats, by vote, win Congress. However, the way the lines are drawn, Republicans have Republicans were taking control of Congress. In fact, they're now only four seats away from taking control of the House of Representatives. And with the new lines that they're drawing, I think it's nearly impossible for the Democrats to keep control of the House. So you've got...
If I could just jump in here, yeah, just for a second. I mean, this is what really puts the lie to Joe Manchin. Unless he's living in space or he's only got outgoing and no incoming, he has to understand that the coup is at the state level, at the and the end of a fair voting system is being engineered now. Could he not know? So this idea of bipartisan, as in like one particular bill he's bipartisan on, but what's going on in the rest of the country in almost every state, he's silent about.
Yes, and as I don't see him saying, well, he doesn't, by the way, challenge the Republicans. He doesn't go to the Republicans and say, why don't one of you stand up for voting rights? Why don't one of you stand up against jacking around with the lines, the congressional lines? Like in California, for example, we have a nonpartisan commission draw the congressional lines. And that's one of the reasons we have a wipeout overwhelming Democratic delegation. It's not because we mess with the lines here. We have a nonpartisan committee of demographic experts draw our lines. When there are fair elections, the GOP loses. It's just that the math is real simple. So, Joe, you know, why don't you ask a Republican to come over and be bipartisan? Why don't you ask a Republican to say, we want to have full exposure of who's buying our elections? Now, of course, you have to ask another question. Well, maybe Joe doesn't want to tell us where he's getting his money. And, you know, I just talked to a political insider who said he's totally coked up. I mean, it's the Coke, it's Charles Koch is his big money. And also, don't forget coal mining. You know, you've got some pretty monstrous people who are operating these coal mines, and that's what controls the coal mining, controls West Virginia politics, which is, and therefore, very right wing. So, you know, again, we're talking about Manchin, but it's who's behind Manchin. I mean, that's aiming at the puppet. What about the puppeteer like Charles Koch? But he's not obviously saying why, you know, that elections should be fair. He says our democracy depends on bipartisanship. Well, actually, where does it say that in the Constitution? Our democracy depends on elected leaders who are elected by the people, not by the cash. So these are the two bills which, unless Manchin votes for it, that only leaves 49 at best. And, of course, Kyrsten Sinema, the Democratic right-wing senator out of Arizona, has also said that she wouldn't bust the filibuster, though she has said she's for the voting. She's for the bill, but she doesn't want a chance to vote on it. She's actually saying, I don't want to have a chance to vote on the bill I support, which is vital to our democracy, vital to fairness. That's what she's saying. But, you know, I'm hoping... I think I'll be making a call myself to find out. The head of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, I've known for 40 years, is also was the head of the Mine Workers Union. And I know he's for this bill, but I think we also need to figure out a way for the mine workers to be able to reach out. And I think one way is, of course, guaranteeing coal miners' job, as FDR did. He said when there was no demand for coal during the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt created something called the Civilian Conservation Corps and told the miners, get out of the pits, because there's no jobs there, take your shovels and build something called the Appalachian Trail. And many, many more people are employed in tourism on the Appalachian Trail than are employed in the coal mines of West Virginia. It's really a tourist state. It's not a coal mining state. It's just that the coal mining companies control the politics. So, that's where I think Progressive has to start talking with the coal miners. Because as Rich Trumka once told me, the head of the coal miners union, now head of AFL-CIO, no one, Greg, wants to work in a coal mine. But they do want union wages, union jobs, union pay. If we do what Roosevelt did and say, you got that, but you're going to be building, you're going to be expanding the Appalachian Trail, you're not going to get objection from the coal miners. And if they take away that fear, I think that Manchin is going to get Manchin.
Yeah, You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. We're talking about what's going on with Joe Manchin. I hesitated to mention his name, but he is really at the center of the future. This one guy from this small state, it really is going to have a lot to say about the future of this country, and it is it's quite troubling. Now, I want to just coax you out a little bit on the two bills. Did I hear, as a practical matter, I'm not that much of a practical sort of guy, but I think I want to be practical right now. I think you were saying, Greg, that you were hoping to support with some hope the John Lewis bill.
Well, I think that you know, it's not whether I support it, but the issue is that the John Lewis bill is probably the simplest and more urgent. Like, how could anyone?
And it's got the most chance of getting any support at this point.
Yes. But, again, you've got, and it just says that you can't do anything that racially prejudices, that jacks with the elections, rigs the operation of election to favor white voters, is what it comes down to. It's that simple. And Manchin is saying, no, I don't, believe it or not, he can't find Republicans to say we want to protect voters of color. And but he's saying without that, well, where are we going to find that, Mr. Manchin? But again, now we have to be careful because, people have been talking about trying to primary, that is, put up an opponent to Joe Manchin in the Democratic primary. One, they'd probably lose, but even if they don't, Manchin, we just had the governor of West Virginia switch from Democratic to Republican. Manchin could do the same and likely win as a Republican. So we have to be very careful here. That I think that the way to look at this, if we care about the voting rights, is work with, one thing that there's been some dearth of in the people pushing for Green New Deal is working with the coal miners. They want their jobs. They don't care about having coal dust on their face or in their lungs. They'd rather not. I'm telling you that now. So there is maybe some way to work around Manchin and maybe Manchin him through the coal miners. But I'm very concerned that we start thinking about don't cede to the Republicans. Don't cede to Trump. When Trump, for example, ended, virtually gutted the rules about the emissions from coal plants, from power plants, allowing coal plants to keep operating. And he had a bunch of miners behind him, wearing their hard hats with the little lights on it, real good photo op. And he said, got rid of the anti-pollution law. So now we're all sucking extra soot. And he turns around to these coal miners, this stage thing, and says, you know what this means, boys? You're going back to work. By the way, those guys didn't go back to work because coal is really expensive compared to natural gas and really expensive compared to wind power. So you're kind of, no one wants to run a coal plant. The only coal plant that's been reopened is one that's dedicated to mining Bitcoin. So other than that, coal plants are pretty much on their way out anyway. So I think that we can start, it's funny, I'm talking about, coal mining when we start out with voting rights, but you have to put these things together. We have to make people feel comfortable with, they understand that if you have voting rights, you're going to have a very different Congress and the Green New Deal will pass. And you have to remove that fear of the people in West Virginia that they're going to lose those coal mining jobs. They're going to lose those jobs that we need to talk about giving them other jobs, as FDR did. I think that's really important. We can't just talk about let's have voting rights because people understand the political consequences of that.
Right. But and it's all about economic justice, Right. The vote comes with economic justice, and that's never really been built into the struggle. But there are some interesting things popping up around that now. But I guess, Greg, I want to shift with you for the last few minutes we have with you. There are a couple of battlefronts that you've been engaged with. I know you're laser-focused on Georgia. There's also what's going on in Texas. Can you give us a sense of what that looks like, kind of crazy things going on in Arizona?
Texas, Arizona, and Georgia, where in Arizona there is a so-called recount of the vote out of Phoenix, which is the Democratic area. They're looking at the mail-in ballots. But, of course, even Republicans have been nervous about that because they grabbed the ballots out of the government offices, took it to a private company. No one watched what they were doing with those ballots. Now, you have to understand, the fancy term is chain of custody. But, the idea that, someone goes in a room and you don't know what some private operator did with the ballots, and then they said, oh, well, we recounted it, and guess who won? Trump really won. Sorry. And understand, if we were on, the One Network or one of the other right-wing networks, we'd be talking about the inauguration of Trump in August. That's the trope that's going on in right-wing media, that these recounts will restore Donald Trump to office. And we think we may laugh at this, but don't laugh, my friends. In Georgia, the Republicans have forced... have gotten themselves a recount, a review of all the mail-in ballots in Fulton County. Now, why Fulton? That's the big hunk of Atlanta. It's black and Democratic voters. And they're not recounting votes in Valdosta. They're not recounting votes, basically in redneck Georgia. They're counting the votes only in urban Democratic black Fulton. And there are about 130-some thousand votes there that will be recounted. That is, and here's the problem. In Georgia, you have a system called Exact Match. So if you signed your name on your registration form is Dennis J. Bernstein, yet on your mail-in ballot you signed Dennis Bernstein, my friend, you just lost your vote. They'll disqualify it. If you signed Garcia Marquez and you included the hyphen and the accent and the enye, the tilde, your vote, and it wasn't that way on your driver's license because they left off the accent off the driver's license, you lose your vote, et cetera. This is if there's a mismark, if there is a red pen, a pencil, instead of a blue or a black pen filling in that ballot, you lose your vote. If you put a check mark instead of filling the bubble, you lose your vote. This way, they are hoping to find, and they well could find, 12,000 ballots to disqualify on these cockamamie, picayune grounds, but that would give Trump of the state, and they'll claim, oh, look, there was massive fraud. No, just picayune junk, check marks, wrong pen, wrong, and forgot your middle initial, whatever it is. And so I'm very concerned about Georgia. I'm very concerned about what's happening in Arizona. And in Texas, the legislature the Republicans are trying to jam through a completely nutso bill we've talked about on the air that would prevent, that would severely limit the right of voters to vote. It'd be almost impossible to vote by mail unless you, like, bring in a surgeon holding your liver saying, I just have to put in the new liver so they can't vote on that day. I mean, that's hyperbole, but that's almost what it requires to mail in your ballot. Cutting early voting hours, eliminating drop boxes, et cetera, and eliminating, for example, drive-through voting, which was very valuable during a pandemic and for off-hours people, and 24/7 voting in Houston. The Republicans they don't want to convince the voters to vote. They want to stop the voters from voting in Texas. So the Democrats walked out. And here's the good news, Dennis. The Democrats walked out, denied a quorum, so they couldn't vote in Texas. But what makes that extraordinary, not before, when Texas 15 years ago attempted to gerrymander the vote, the Democrats not only walked out of the Capitol to prevent the quorum, but then the governor, the Republican governor, you'll love this, called out the Texas Rangers to arrest the Democrats and bring them in chains into the chamber so they could be counted for a quorum. So the Democrats literally left the state. The entire Democratic legislature left the state. But after 2 months, with their kids saying, where's daddy or where's mommy, they came back and they gerrymander the deal. But see, their legislators were actually fighting, frankly, for their own seats to prevent the gerrymander. Here they're fighting for your vote. That's very different. This is a first for the Democratic Party when white Democrats were literally willing to bring down, stop the legislature for the right to vote. That is a sea change, not only in America, but it's extraordinary for the Democratic Party to finally stand up and say, the vote is primary. How about that? A Democratic Party for democracy, it's very refreshing and brand new.
It feels slightly late, Greg. There's a certain urgency here. Yeah. There's a certain urgency, wouldn't you say, in terms of like the paths that we're heading down? And we haven't seen the end of the violence. That's the other side of this.
Yes,
we haven't talked about the violence, but it's simmering.
Well, actually, I want to say that for the first time, I'm looking at violations. For the first time in 100 years, I'm looking at violations of the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1878. After the Civil War, a progressive abolitionist Congress passed a law against killing voters, intimidating them, stopping them from voting. It's a crime. You go to jail. And I was just investigating mass violations of the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1878 in Georgia, in Texas, in North Carolina, in Florida. They're not using white sheets, they're using spreadsheets, but it's the same thing. It's a mass crime, and I'm hoping that Garland Nixon, our new attorney general, will step forward and say, okay, I can't believe we're doing this, but we're going to have to bust people under the Klan Act. And you don't have to wear a white sheet to be busted under the Klan Act. But they're pulling the same stunt, and this stuff has got to end. I'll be reporting more on the details. We don't have time now. But yes, there is violence, threats of violence, intimidation. It is against federal law. Time to bring in the federales and say, basta, enough. We haven't used this law in 100 years. I think it's time.
Before we let you go, just a few seconds, the big dates, the big things you're watching for, you're coming and going and keeping an eye on this? Where are you zooming in on?
Yeah, Chuck Schumer has said that he wanted to have the vote on the two voting rights bills in July before they go on recess. And, unless there's some pressure on Manchin or maybe pick off a Republican who may see, the so-called, that's the other thing, is to actually win over one Republican. The other is that I'm looking at, obviously, the Texas legislature and the Georgia recount and other games. So we don't have any serious deadlines, mainly because it's impossible to get anything progressive voted in.
And there is a recount going on, another one in Georgia, right? We're not done. Yes. Georgia's not done.
That's why I say there's the Fulton County recount. Yeah. And that was promoted, by the way, by Brad Raffensperger, the guy that, you know, again, 60 Minutes, NBC, said, he's the great hero because he stood up to Trump. Understand, as the ACLU told me, all the guy did was he wanted to stay out of prison. You do understand that what Trump was asking to do was a felony crime. And this guy jacked with the voter rolls. He jacked with the precincts. He has called for this phony recount to try to put Trump over the top. What he couldn't do was what Trump asked. Trump basically told him, take 12,000 ballots in another room and disqualify them. That's what he's really saying. Go find, just knock out 12,000 ballots. Make me president. That's a problem. Also, one other deadline we have in Wisconsin, where the legislature, once again, is trying to put through horrendous voter purge laws and other limitations. But luckily, there is Tony Evers and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. They're going to veto that bill. But there is a court case which could restore some of the legislature's demand for removal of 135,000 voters. I was in Milwaukee. They're almost all black and student voters being removed on bogus, suspicious grounds. They know exactly what they're doing. But remember, Biden only won that state officially by 10,000 votes. They knock out 10,000 students, 20,000 African-Americans in Milwaukee. They've got the state again. It's very dangerous stuff. Amazing. And it's, again, not whether I'm against Republicans taking back control of Wisconsin. I just think the voters should make that decision and not the Jim Crow cockamamie trickery.
Right. We don't want all these elections mentioned. Not to come back to the subject of the day, and it's a horrible subject. And we're going to leave it right there. Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. You should go there, check out the work he's been doing. He's been doing it for a long time, fighting for your vote. Greg Palast, we thank you for spending the time with us again and endlessly reporting on this crucial subject.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you for Pacifica and KPFA for allowing this information through the electronic Berlin Wall. You don't get it anywhere else, and I do appreciate it. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a nice, comfortable musical break. You can inhale, exhale, do a yoga move or two, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about a battle going on in rural Nevada.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat. But we have it so well under control. It's going to disappear. One day, it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. And this is their new hoax.
Well, I think treatment in many ways might be more exciting.
You know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work. But they get better.
You are an idiot.
Okay, that was the theme of some time ago for the election crimes bulletin, and I like it a lot. It reminds us that the president that's going to be reinstated in August is really still an idiot. Greg Palast. Actually, that is Manchin. Should Manchin be a verb? Is it time we made Manchin a verb? That's the title of Greg Palast's story, and it actually links to the audio on SoundCloud. So if you want to circulate that through other mechanisms, other articles he's had, he has one about the Texas Dems walking out in support of voting rights. Cyber ninjas and voting pandas. You know, they were looking at the ballots with microscopes to see if there was bamboo fiber in it in Arizona. Did you hear that one? They were. Because there was a rumor that it wasn't Venezuela that was fixing the ballots. It was China, of course, China being the optimum enemy. I think I'll probably do something on that tomorrow when I'm back for a window on the world. Here's one, Deepwater Horizon corporate homicide. He covered that at the time, and he's doing a 10-year retrospective or so on that a while back. Article on Wisconsin. The indefatigable Greg Palast, he's got some really weird video from Georgia as well. Some woman who has challenged a record number of votes in the voting got an invitation to do an interview. She didn't know who he was. Apparently she had loaded guns all over the place, so he couldn't be too obstreperous. Greg Palast, opinions you hear, did I say that already? Are those of the speakers not necessarily shared by others? We've got almost a quorum of the Radio Free Labor. I haven't done any pitching of that. There's some outside music, inside music. Pipa's doing inside and outside tonight, I noted.
Yeah. That's what I hear.
Yeah, that's Bob Pelesny, who knows about the blues around town. But he also knows about labor issues, and that's what is the matter at hand. Stephanie's still on holiday? We don't know. We don't know. Okay. Well, I hope she shows up. Maybe she'll call in. Thanks for listening. If you're listening, call in. And we got an underwriting announcement here, and I think it might be even the right one to play at this point. So over to you, gents.